What's up, everyone? Welcome back. Another episode of the New Evangelicals. I got to find a better intro, or maybe not. That's just what I say. But hey, good to have you back on this episode. This is a powerful one, friends. I interviewed Jamar Tisby. He wrote the foreword to a book. I have it right here, called The Coming Race Wars by Dr. William Pannell, who's actually a heavyweight in this field. You probably never heard of him, but he's been doing the work since like the 50s. This guy's the OG. This interview with Jamar, there's not a lot of words for it, honestly. It was eye-opening. It was thought-provoking. Jamar just, you know, he just spoke from his heart, and I loved it. It was great. He is someone that, man, I just want to follow all the way. Like, Jamar, I'm behind you. He's doing such great work when it comes to race relations and just, to get the word out that, like, hey, there's a problem that we have to address in the church. So this one might challenge you, friends. I'm going to tell you right now, you know, it challenged me to better elevate Black voices, to donate more, to give them more time, to just elevate them on any platform I have. So I have a lot to think about, honestly, but I hope you guys enjoy this podcast. In fact, you know, I usually ask at this point, you know, make sure you like and subscribe, which please do. It helps us to subscribe to the show and like it and review it. And I also usually ask for donations at this point, but do me a favor, don't donate to me. I'm going to put a link in here for The Witness. That's Jamar's thing. If you were thinking about donating to me for this episode, instead donate to Jamar, give them those finances. There's plenty to go around. We can all, you know, make a living and survive doing this together. But I think it's important to do that. So anyway, I'm going to stop rambling. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'll talk to you all soon. Well, Jamar, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for making time. I really appreciate it.
I've been looking forward to this conversation. Our pre-show banter has already been good, so it's going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. You know, it's interesting because I've always wanted to have you on the New Evangelicals podcast, and I kind of got you on in a roundabout way because the publisher for the book we're talking about, The Coming Race Wars, Krista is her name. She reaches out to, I guess, a bunch of us, and I saw this book and said, I want this book, and if I can get Jamar on, or even at the time I asked for the author, and she said, well, Jamar's doing the interviews. I said, perfect. A match made in heaven.
You're like, I've had to settle for a lot of things in the past year and a half. It's been a pandemic, so I'm used to settling for second best. So you get me.
Well, why don't we start off here? Yeah, go ahead.
Trust me when I say you would rather talk to Dr. Bill Pannell, but he celebrated, I want to say, his 86th birthday recently. And so he's living, he's taking care of his wife, who's not in the best health, but they've been together forever.
Wow.
And still sharp as a tack, and literally one of my mentors. So I'm happy to stand in his stead, but there's absolutely no replacing Bill Pannell.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad to have you on. You know, I didn't know who Dr. Bill Pannell was till this book. I did some digging on him, you know, teaching for 40 years. He wrote this book, I guess, in 92, The Coming Race Wars, and now it's being re-released in 2021. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. But there's so much to Dr. William Bill Pannell. So okay. If I can just, you know, gush here. So I encountered Dr. Pannell in my research into Tom Skinner. This is all part of my dissertation looking at, part of it looks at Black evangelicals in the 20th century. And when you do that, you quickly stumble on Tom Skinner, who was a nationally renowned evangelist. They called him the Black Billy Graham, which has all kinds of issues with it, but it gives you a sense of kind of his notoriety and his style. But his right-hand man, his lieutenant in his organization, Tom Skinner Associates, was Bill Pannell. And in many ways, although Tom Skinner was the voice, Bill Pannell helped to shape the ideas that Skinner then amplified through his really magnetic teaching and preaching. So in addition to The Coming Race Wars, which came out in the 90s, Bill Pannell did something pretty exceptional long before that. Back in 67 or 68, he published a book called My Friend, the Enemy. My Friend, the Enemy, talking about his experience as a Black man with white evangelicals. And this is in, this is the height of the Black Power movement, right? So this is all coming together at the same time. And he does this sort of, it's really the first book, especially one published by an evangelical publisher that was, it was Zondervan that published it.
Yeah.
And so they were taking a huge risk in the late 60s to publish a sort of Black person's insider account of white evangelical racism. So that's how far ahead of his time he's been. But he's also always been dedicated to the beloved community, to trying to make this interracial thing work. And so that's where he goes with Fuller Theological Seminary. First, he was the first Black person on their board of trustees, then gets appointed as a professor. And he just never leaves. I mean, it's Southern California. It's Pasadena, so I don't blame him. But he never leaves. 40 years, they name William Pennell Center after him at Fuller. And he's an institution in and of himself. He is a repository of so much that has happened of import within evangelicalism, especially regarding race. And so he's just one of these folks where you sit down and you can listen to him for hours because the stories he tells are just gripping. And I'm so honored to have written this foreword. And I've had the pleasure and the privilege of having many, many conversations with Bill Pennell. And I said from the start when they asked me to write this new sort of expansion, this new introduction to the coming race wars, I said, when I write this, if I never write another word, I'm fine. Because I got to do something with Bill Pennell.
Amazing. You know, from the little I read about him, and then of course reading this book, it was a really powerful and thought provoking read for me on this end. Just reading it, being like, wow, this was written in 92. But it could have been written this year and still be just as applicable, which in one hand shows how ahead of his time he was. Right. On the other hand, is a little discouraging, you know, that a lot of the same issues are still kind of happening. And his critique is still a very valid critique. Maybe some ways it's even deeper and dare I say even worse off than before, you know, in a lot of ways, especially with what we've seen from, I would say the more fundamentalist slash reform movement these days. In the book, the chapter I want to hone in on, I really enjoyed, as I think such a poignant chapter was the one entitled Evangelicals in Their Urban Crisis. And he really talks about, now this is the 90s, right? How, you know, white churches left this inner cities and then critiqued Black churches for being, I don't know, whatever, too radical. But yet he makes the point in the chapter that the Black church holds the very orthodox beliefs. Why do you think this critique keeps on happening over and over and over again without really any merit? Because that is, I mean, I've been part of many friends who pastor, you know, Black American churches, and they are as orthodox and sometimes even more than me with their beliefs, you know? I don't understand.
So I mean, there's a thing called theological racism, theological racism, which says that any theology arising out of Black and brown, Black or brown communities is almost inherently inferior. And nobody would ever say that. We're not that blatant with it, but it comes through. I was in seminary, brother. It took me 5 years to get my master's degree. I was in seminary a good minute. The only time I ever heard about Black theology was in the context of what not to do.
Wow.
And these are men, you know, these are guys, professors who you wouldn't mind sitting down, having a coffee with, a beer with, if they're Presbyterian, you know, they know the Greek, they know the Hebrew, and they're not malicious or anything. But what does it say? Number one, that there was a glaring absence of any voices of color overall. So I actually had to I don't say this much. It's not secret. The conversation really never goes here, but I did my master's in divinity at Reformed Theological Seminary, emphasis in missions. Why? It's the only one that takes culture seriously and centrally in terms of a theological education, in my experience, right? So if I wanted to read theologians of color, if I wanted to learn about cultures that weren't European or white American, I had to do the missions concentration, not because I had any calling to like go overseas and evangelize, but because that's where you got the culture. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that. It's because people don't think, lots of white people, especially the ones who teach this stuff, don't think that the theology coming out of these different people groups and contexts has as much to say. Now, all of that's a roundabout way to get around to why Dr. Pinnell wrote that chapter. And he's emphasizing, listen, we have more in common than we do different.
Right.
Particularly theologically, right? Like, yes, we're going to check all the same boxes on the Trinity, the divinity of Christ and the resurrection, the need for personal repentance, all of that stuff.
Right.
Right in line. And the only difference is the color line.
Yeah.
And guess what? That's not even new. That's not a 90s thing. That goes back to right after the Civil War.
Yeah.
One of the first things Black people did was form their own denominations.
Yep.
Because they were tired of being treated as second-class citizens in the household of God.
Yeah.
So it's got a very long history. And then can I add one more layer to this?
Of course.
So now, as we record this, cities are cool again. You know, people are going back to cities. They are gentrifying areas. Like, that's the controversy and the conflict now. What do we do about all these wealthy people coming into these materially poor areas and just taking over and kicking out people, right?
Yep.
Well, back 20, 30 years ago, and a bit further, when Dr. Pinnell was writing this, white people were fleeing the city. Just a mass exodus of white folks to the suburbs, right?
Yep.
And there's all kinds of history around, they call them covenants, these racially exclusive covenants, where you'd have these posh subdivisions, and there would be a written or a verbal kind of understanding that we're not going to let certain kinds of people in here, right? Now, this is after official, federal housing authority redlining.
Right.
But they still maintained the color line, and they did it through these racially restrictive covenants. They did it through unspoken agreements, and they most of all did it through money, where people of a certain income just couldn't afford to be there. And guess what? Most of the people who could afford to be there are white. So there's this fleeing of the cities and the churches along with it.
Yep.
Quick story. The church I went to in Jackson, Mississippi, it started with a building and a core group of people. But the vast majority of it was an existing congregation, is what I'm saying. And the reason that this intentionally multiracial church took over and got its start there is because this predominantly white congregation relocated to a white suburb. And then they basically set up the arrangement for the Black pastor to come in and do this interracial thing, right? And wow. This is, early 2000s, right? So it's not that long ago. So I just wanted to set the context for Dr. Pinnell writing about this quote unquote urban crisis is, it was in the context of white people in general and white evangelicals in particular, just fleeing the cities and characterizing them as these dens of iniquity that didn't have Jesus, these benighted places spiritually and materially. And the only contact a white evangelical might have speaking, you know, in generalizations.
Sure, but, of course.
What Dr. Pinnell is responding to, the only contact a white evangelical might have with the inner city is some sort of paternalistic parachute in relief, you know,
yes,
giving out food, do a Bible study or a, you know, summer day camp kind of thing and parachute out.
That's right.
So that was the context.
Well, I'm listening to the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, the podcast Christianity Today. It's great. I'm literally addicted. And I think it's in that series where they talk about how some of those early mega churches in like the 80s and 90s, you know, the story they would tell is we felt God leading us here, but the reality was they were doing their research and finding that, okay, all the people who we want to attract are in the suburbs now. So let's plant in Orange County. Let's plant in this suburb. And you have this intentional, I guess we can call it white, you know, flight in a lot of ways, saying we're out of the city. And you know, we'll just say God led us, and maybe to a degree they felt that, but it was also backed up by data that, oh, this also makes sense as well, right? And I do want to read, you know, there is a quote in the book that I read and thought, wow, this is so accurate. It's a little bit long, but I would love to get your reaction to it. It's kind of what you're talking about. He says in the book, suburban churches that have any contact with the city will continue to critique the viability of the urban church's definitions of ministry there. But black Christians find it difficult to listen. They know that white churches opted out of the city years ago, thus forfeiting the right to define anything for them. They also know that while the white church, especially its evangelical wing, is often critical of urban churches' attempts to contextualize the gospel, there is no better example of questionable contextualization than the experience of that very suburban church. He goes on to say, and this for me, this one gave me chills when I read it. Truly, it is sometimes hard to tell where the evangelical church leaves off and secular American culture begins. Now, if that is not a prophetic word for 2021 and 2016 all the way through, I do not know what is. Because for a good minute, I thought this book was written in 2021. When I read that, I'm like, he's talking about now, right? Because, I mean, and this is honestly why my account, The New Evangelicals, has grown the way it has and why we continue to grow. Because I'm sure you know, a lot of us are deconstructing this secular American nationalism with Christianity baked right into the mix of it. And we're reading authors like you, like Ibram Kendi, like this book. You know, I'm reading Stand from the Beginning. And I tweeted the other day, I was taught American mythology, not American history as a child. Ooh, you know?
Come on now. Come through.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
What's your Twitter account? I got to follow right now.
At New Evangelicals, no E. But
there you go.
But my point is that, you know, I'm just realizing that this is not new, but it is in full, the fruit is ripe, so to speak, right? And the seeds have been planted for a long time. You know, what are some of your thoughts on this stuff?
So I'm gonna start in reverse and start with the practical, because I was just posting about it this morning on Facebook. There was somebody who had asked me to be on a podcast with one of these, critical race theorist fearmongers, one of these folks crying, you know, the sky is falling because of this obscure legal theory literally taught in law school, not K through 12, but that's a whole other story.
Uh-huh. So we can go there.
They asked me to be on this show, and I'm like, no, because they wanted this sort of debate, whatever. I'm like, no, but here's a more helpful thing to do. Amplify voices of people who have researched racial justice and anti-racism, and people who are advocating for it, and activists who are taking action on it. Yeah. Because oftentimes those voices are drowned out by the people, you know, crying wolf over some pet culture war issue that changes, you know, with every couple of years.
Absolutely.
So, you know, to the folks listening to this, I think one of the most helpful and effective things you can do is amplify the voices of Dr. Bill Pinnell through the coming race wars, right? Tweet about that, share about that, pull your quotes about that, and give less of the airtime or the mic time to these folks who are, honestly, it's not about debate. Debate has to be good faith on both sides.
Totally agree.
And most of this stuff is not in good faith. The good faith efforts to understand critical race theory are not coming from the people who have the microphones and who are at the most extreme side of it. It's the regular folks who look at these people that they trust or their voices they want to listen to, the people who have a platform, and it's those people who are crying wolf about critical race theory. And it's the regular folks. Yeah. The folks who fill the pews, the folks who are just parents and going to work every day. It's the regular folks who are like, wait a minute, is there something to this? I do want to know more.
Right.
That's
right.
Different. That's totally different.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is,
yeah,
even for those folks who really genuinely want to know, well, what should we think about this? Bill Pinnell knew. Bill Pinnell knew 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Bill Pinnell, if you go back to the 70s, he knew 50 years ago. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Why didn't we know?
Right. Right.
It's because voices like his, the prophets, get drowned out.
Yeah.
And so he knew from an inside perspective. I mean, he's with white evangelicals way before it was socially acceptable. I'm talking all the way back to the 50s.
Mm.
When he's a teenager, you know.
Right.
He's got interaction. I think he comes to faith through, it was an Anabaptist tradition. It might have been Quakers, you know. So he's been around white Christians a real long time. And by the time he publishes My Friend the Enemy, he knows the score. And he never sort of sells out his own people. He never sells out Black people in the midst of it. Always maintained a vital connection to urban areas and predominantly Black areas, and has immense respect from Black people, which is a big indicator, right? Yeah, a lot of the Black folks that folks on the right like to lift up do not have following from Black people, which is telling.
Yeah.
So I don't know what your question was, but man, it's there. Yeah.
You know, as someone who I'm so, you know, I read both of your books. They're great, by the way. And last time you and I talked on my old podcast, you know, I kind of asked, like, you know, where does someone like me start? Because this is so new to me. And I feel like I have no right to make any statements about things I do not know anything about, right? Like, I'm not sure if you, do you know how to play drums by any chance? Are you a drummer?
Novice.
All right.
Best friend played drums, and so I followed along with him.
Well, I imagine, like, you know, if you came over, I've been playing for 20 years, and you're like, listen, Tim, here's the right techniques. I'd be like, well, I appreciate your opinion on this, same kind of idea here. We're like, a lot of people like myself, right? We were steeped in evangelical culture. We learned the mythology of America. America's a good God-fearing nation. We grew up on talk radio. That's my life, right? And all of a sudden, over the past, like, maybe, I don't know, 10 years or so, right? I'm 32. So yeah, past 10 years, slowly seeds are planted of, like, maybe it's not all what I think. And now I'm realizing, like, wow, it's nothing like what I think. And all I can do is listen, and elevate voices that are not mine, right? And so it's like, I think what I'm having a hard time with is just realizing how deep this rabbit hole goes. I mean, it's truly shocking. It's unbelievable. And guys like you know, Dr. Pinnell here, the books that they've written, I'm wondering, I mean, why weren't these ever, I wasn't exposed to this. I can give you the books I was exposed to. This was not one of them. And this guy's been doing the real work. He's an OG. And I never heard of this guy. And he's a devoted Christian, right? Mm-hmm. Devoted Jesus follower, mm-hmm. putting in the work. And my faith tradition knows nothing about him.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is blown.
That's by design.
Yeah.
You know, so here's the thing. People, I think we have this impression that racists are walking around in white robes and hoods with torches, and we'll know it when we see it. Mm. But as long as we're not seeing that, it's not happening. Because what I'm trying to emphasize is, when I say this is by design, I'm not saying that you have this group of white men in a boardroom twisting their mustaches saying, ha, 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 how are we going to keep Black people out?
Right.
It's not that blatant, usually, sometimes, right. Sure. But what happens is subtle. So there was a study that said in a 100 friend scenario, if you break it down by race, white people would have 90 friends who are white, and the rest of the 10 are different racial groups. Of that 10 that are different racial groups, white people in a 100 friend scenario would have one black friend. Now, why do you have one black friend? Well, part of it's quantity. Up until the 21st century, white people have been by far the majority demographically, but it's also because of things like redlining and restrictive covenants and segregated schools. So there is an intentionality to keep white and black people apart. And then when that's your social network and you go to say, okay, I need to put together my syllabus or I need to fill my church library, are you going to go to black people? No, you got that one quote unquote black friend, which they don't, the study doesn't say, you know, how close a friend that is.
Right.
And what are the chances that they're, you know, they've published a book or something like that, right? So it just gets sort of instantiated because of the way society is broadly structured, which is along racial lines, which is racist, which is white supremacist. And then when that happens so long for years and years and years and years, even though the book, for instance, My Friend the Enemy, made a splash when it came out, yeah, it's been 50 years. Right. And when that amount of time passes for any book, it's going to fade. But especially when the people with the biggest platforms and the biggest microphones aren't trumpeting this kind of stuff, it's going to get lost. Goes back to my point I made a minute ago. What can we do is amplify these voices. How do we make sure the coming race wars doesn't get drowned out? First of all, it's this beautiful cover.
It right? is a good cover. Yeah.
Let's just pause cool. and acknowledge this is eye-catching.
I thought about that.
So you know, the folks at University Press have done their part, and Dr. Yeah. Bill Pinnell has done his part. We have to do our part.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're doing it with this podcast and talking about the book. Are the folks listening? Are you going to post about it on Facebook, on Twitter, on your email blast, in your staff meeting at your church? Is it going to be in your library at your church? Like, are you going to request it for your local library? Like, this is the real work that individuals can do. And nobody have to have anything special to amplify good work.
What do you say? You know, because I'm still pretty steeped intentionally on following a lot of these like reformed circles, fundamentalist circles. I mean, I watch what they say. I'm watching David Platt's mutiny on his hands right now. I'm not sure if you heard about
that. That's incredible.
It's unbelievable. All right, you know things are bad when David Platt's too liberal. Like what? Okay, but I digress. You know, I'm pretty tuned in. I watched the SBC stuff. I've seen all that stuff. I've read the books that have come out. You know, and here's the big critique in air quotes I hear, right? This isn't the gospel. This is not the true gospel. Social justice isn't biblical justice. You know, it's these taglines, but ironically, like you said, assuming that for them, because they like to simplify the gospel is the death and resurrection of Jesus for the forgiveness of sins. Let's assume that that's what it is. We would say, yeah, of course. Yeah, that is. Yeah. What's wrong with that? So what do you say to that? I think, you know, ridiculous, but it's a critique that people take seriously to that critique of, hey, man, stick to the gospel, okay? Yeah. This is not a gospel issue.
Right. I mean, asking questions, because the reality is, I can't remember who said it, but it just rocked me. And I think it was on a completely different issue, but they were dealing with a similar dynamic of people who had a very shallow understanding of something they said was very dangerous. And this person said, you know, somebody's one follow-up question away from exposing themselves, from exposing their ignorance, from exposing their racism, right? Yeah. So question after question after question. Number one, questions, depending on how you ask them, can be a lot less confrontational than just sort of retorting or giving a rebuttal, right?
Absolutely.
You say your point, I'll say my point, and we're going back and forth, back and forth. You say your point. Where did you learn that? It's going to be a remarkably consistent answer with a lot of folks. They're going to say some right wing pundit.
Totally.
It's going to be some personality on Fox News. It's going to be some personality on their own sort of independent podcast or whatever it might be. And then you keep asking questions. Well, have you read so-and-so on this topic? Do you know any of the history behind this? Is there a way, do you think, that racism can still occur without these more overt forms of somebody using the N-word or putting a sign over a drinking fountain, right? Mm-hmm. Or when did racism end, do you think? Like, when did it cease to become like this major social issue? Because most people, even folks who are really, really concerned about critical race theory, they'll say racism, it's undeniable, it's been a problem, right? And then, but a long time ago, and right. Today it's not a problem, right?
Right?
So then ask them, you know, when did it cease to become this big problem that you admit it once was?
Right.
So all I'm saying is, like, when you ask these questions, it reveals people's, you know, centimeter deep understanding of what actually is going on with racial dynamics. You know, back to your drumming analogy, right? It's like they picked up drumsticks. They just got it out of the package. Like, right. It comes with the wrapped in that little cardboard thing. You pull it out. They
right.
just got it out.
That's
and
right.
now they're saying, this is how you do it.
Right.
And you're right. like, really?
Right.
Yeah. When how do you use the hi-hat?
Right.
You know? What do you think about you know, who's your favorite drummer, right?
Right, right.
All of that.
Right. Well, yeah. I feel like that really applies right now to the biggest, the newest boogeyman, the CRT boogeyman.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
It's coming
absolutely.
For your wives, coming from your kids. You got to hide everyone, right? I mean,
they're passing laws.
Oh, my goodness. I got to say, it is impressive how quick a conservative Christian political movement can really redefine something that has existed for what, 50 years, 45, 50 years in academia, right? Not a peep. And all of a sudden, it's like this has just, the devil himself has stirred this up and thrown it. Almost like in Power Rangers when Rita throws the guy down to earth and he just like, yeah, that's what I think about. It's like out of nowhere, right? Here it comes. And it's also impressive how they've been able to redefine what CRT is. Now, listen, I need to say right now, I can just see the surface from 10,000 feet of CRT. That's my knowledge of this, all right? But I can tell you, it ain't what I'm being told. You know, why this push to just to demonize an academic law term in your perspective?
It's to reinstantiate white supremacy.
Wow.
Quite simply. Hmm. This happens throughout U.S. history. I don't study critical race theory either. I study history.
Right.
And you don't need to have this legal framework to discover, oh, this stuff is this what I say in The Color of Compromise. Racism never goes away. It just adapts.
Yes.
And the adaptation, the trajectory is from more overt to more covert. And in a way, the more covert is more dangerous because it's less visible.
Right.
Right? Right. Right. Why does carbon monoxide kill people?
Right.
Can't see it, can't smell it, but it's in the air and it's poison.
Yeah.
And that's how racism adapts. Right. We're killing the analogies today.
I love
We got drumming. We got Power Rangers.
Just carbon going for monoxide. It, man.
This is creative.
But you need these analogies to really put like some kind of picture in my mind, you know, because it is hard to grasp. I gotta be honest, like, even for, you know, even as I'm learning, I do feel like, you know, it's not blatant in my face. There aren't people in That's white right. hoods, you know. I can look back at Jim Crow laws and now they're technically not on the books, at least as blatantly, right? Mm-hmm. So it is, and I wouldn't say hard, but I've had to really like adjust my lens and have to listen, just listen and read, listen and read, listen and read, because it is not as blatant as I would like to think it is in my context, right?
That's right.
Which doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that my lens is not correct.
That's right. Okay. There's so much to unpack here. One thing is, you know, people are like, well, you guys keep saying systemic racism and that's what it is. And what's an example? There's lots of books on this. A new one out is it How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith. Another book is Elizabeth S. Hinton, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. That's a really good one because she unpacks this idea of quote unquote law and order, which gets back to Bill Pinnell talking about the urban crisis.
Yes.
In the 60s, especially when there are these urban uprisings or rebellions, right? White people want to call them riots, but really it's a powder keg of all of these problems in the inner city, which have been created by people, by white people that are discriminating against Black and brown people. I don't have time to go into the history of all that right now.
Sure.
But, you know, when you're in this sort of concentrated situation of injustice and every now and again, the lid pops off, white people want to call that a riot. People who study this stuff call it an uprising or a rebellion against oppression, right? So anyway, you know, you have huge urban uprisings like Watts in 1965, which, by the way, as a demonstration between white evangelicals and Black Christians, Billy Graham gets word of it. This is all over the country. It's a huge deal. He goes to LA, to Watts, and puts on a bulletproof vest and gets in a helicopter and flies above the carnage and then comes back saying, we need more law and order. Comes back preaching a message of, you know, we got too many lawless people and the nation is going down the tubes. By contrast, MLK goes too. No bulletproof vest, no helicopter. He walks on the streets. He talks to the people and he comes back saying, a riot is the language of the unheard.
Wow.
Perfect example there of the difference. And that's racism, right? Because everybody knows Watts is a Black neighborhood. You don't even have to say it. And then when you say we need law and order, what are you saying? You're saying we need more policing in Black communities because there's something wrong with those Black people.
Right.
They're prone to criminality. Even when I was in seminary, they told me, don't go to this neighborhood. Don't go to that side of town. Why?
Yeah.
Well, there's all this crime there. Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. Do you know? Because you've never been there. And have you ever noticed that, quote unquote, that part of town always has the Black and brown people?
Right.
Is that because Black and brown people have a gene for criminality, which is what somebody said on a famous podcast recently? Or is it because of something structural?
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
So all of that's going on. And what I'm saying is, if you want examples of systemic racism, look at how policing and incarceration has grown in the past half century or so to make the United States have only 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its incarcerated population, and either a super high percentage, I can't remember if it was 40 or 60% of the Black population that's incarcerated globally is in the US, right?
Wow.
So anyway, that's one of the things. The other thing I'll say is this stuff about critical race theory started in the church. A lot of people now know about it because it got into state lawmakers' offices and even the White House. There was an executive order issued in November, I think, of 2020. Or October, somewhere around there. That's when it went sort of mainstream. But I knew about this stuff back in 2015. When an author we were talking about before we started recording started talking about cultural Marxism. And that quickly morphed into, there was another podcast host. He got a hold of the podcast I did immediately after the 2016 election. If you want to know more about it, go listen to Pass the Mic, our Leave Loud episode. Anyway, he was talking about critical race theory stuff. I can't remember if he used that exact label, but this is back in 2016, right? And fomenting the fear and laying the groundwork for it. And all of this is bubbling up in white fundamentalist evangelical circles long before it hits the political scene. And the last thing I'll say, Robert P. Jones' book, White Too Long, is as in your face about the correlation between whiteness and Christianity and the way whiteness corrupts Christianity as anyone I've seen recently. And Robert P. Jones is the founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. He's a data scientist, and he has all of these statistics that say the probability of a white person being racist increases if they're a Christian. So he looked at all of these measures. He didn't just come right out and ask, hey, are you a racist? Looked at all these indicators, right? That ideas that racists would hold. And he said, you know, the data show that the more Christian a white person is, the higher they're going to rate according to these racist indicators.
Can I say something that might get me in trouble?
Those are the best ones. Go ahead.
Isn't that connection, though, just our American Christian heritage at work? Right? I mean, we can look back and see how the doctrine of discovery, how the Pope gave permission that whatever we discover is ours because Jesus Christ and God told us so. Right? And we can trace that kind of all the way up through, you know, race-based chattel slavery, as you say, and how we have to save the black man by enslaving him for his own good. And then we can go through the Jim Crow laws, and then we can look at Bob Jones going up to the Supreme Court, right, and saying, sorry, the racist should not integrate. And there, I actually have a sermon of his. I have it. It's typed out. And it is the same language we hear today with other topics of if the Bible's clear, God has ordained it, right? And so, I mean, and then we look at 2016, we look at Trump, and we look at all those movements, right? And isn't that the fruit? I mean, I want to say I'm surprised, but the more I read, the more I'm like, I'd be surprised if it wasn't that, because it's in the white evangelical heritage minus the Wesleyan tradition, or those radicals over there, you know, the people like Oberlin College, you know, the guys I love. I'm actually in the middle of, I'm going to show another book, this book here, Discovering an Evangelical Heritage.
Oh, and, I want to see that one.
Okay. Oh, it's a great read. Anyway, so there's definitely the radicals, but the actual culture, like what you should be supporting lands with what you just said. As someone who's trying to reclaim the evangelical mantle, it is sometimes very difficult, Jamar. It's hard work, man.
That's right. Like, what are you reclaiming, at least in the U.S. context, right? Like, how what era, what age, what stream of evangelicalism, at least as adopted by people of European descent, is devoid of this toxic admixture of whiteness and white supremacy. And the Bible says, if you add anything to the gospel, it's not the gospel anymore. So what's happened in the United States is they added white supremacy to the gospel.
Yeah.
It's no longer the gospel, but guess what? They're still using gospel language.
100%.
They're still calling it the gospel. They're still calling it Christianity. They're still calling it holy and righteous.
Totally.
But they've added this thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
called white supremacy that actually negates it. Yeah. They can't coexist. And the insidious part, we've been talking a lot about critical race theory. What I also always tell people when it comes up is, CRT. But the real issue, we have to come back to the real issue, which is Christian nationalism.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
We need to spend 150 to 200% more time talking about Christian nationalism than critical race theory. And the insidious part about Christian nationalism is that it is so commonplace, most people just think of it as Christianity.
You're so on the money.
The implication there is if you challenge white supremacy, you're challenging their very faith.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so people think that when I talk about, you know, the insurrection on January 6th, and I'll never forget the date because the day before January 5th is when my book, How to Fight Racism, came out.
Timely.
But on January 6th, you see all of these sort of Christian symbolism.
Oh, yeah.
A huge wooden cross, somebody holding a Bible.
The Christian flag in the Capitol Christian building. Flag,
Trump is my savior. Jesus is my president. All of it, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the QAnon shaman, right?
Oh, yeah.
Saying a prayer, not just a prayer that he closes in Jesus' name.
That's
literally
right.
You can go back and look at the video.
I posted it. You're absolutely right.
Right. And so when you say, actually, this stuff, you know, what we saw at the Capitol is the most extreme visible manifestation, but actually we're seeing it day to day and week to week in churches, in white evangelical churches, white Christian nationalist churches. Why? Yep. How does it's an American flag in the pulpit.
That's right.
It's a huge celebration of the 4th of July, yep. Like it's a liturgical holiday.
Robert Jeffrey's church. Up. I watched it.
Oh my gosh. Yes, absolutely.
It's idolatry.
It's holding up the Constitution as a divinely inspired document.
Yes.
If I had more time in my academic research, I think it would be really fruitful to look at the similarities in hermeneutics between biblical literalists and constitutional originalists.
Yes.
They're using the same hermeneutic a lot of times because these folks are the same folks. They look at the Constitution the way they look at the Bible, which is that it is divinely inspired and you can't mess with it as original in its original whatever, right?
Right.
So there's all of that. And all of that is why for white Christians especially, it is so earth-shattering and disruptive to discover the difference between the Christianity of Jesus and the Christianity of America.
Yes.
Because you just knew it as Christianity.
That's right.
Now you've got to go back and almost start over and say, what can I trust? And I went through this even as a Black person, right? Because I was neck deep in this European Reformed
right.
theology.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Witness, you know, that I started as Reformed African American Network. I went to Reformed Theological Seminary. I was reading Piper and all of these folks.
Sure.
And then, especially around 2014, when Mike Brown is killed and Black Lives Matter comes on the scene nationally, it had actually been created the year before. But, and then you start to speak out like about police brutality and systemic racism. And I saw the backlash among these Reformed folks who I thought were my group.
Totally.
It was disorienting, to put it nicely.
You know, I've had to hold back screaming yes the whole time for the sake of the podcast audio. And if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see me doing this and nodding the whole time because you're really speaking my language now, Jamar. You know, this stuff gets me fired up because the picture you painted is the picture that millions of us have just like woken up to, you know, like over, I would say a lot of us have been thinking about it. I would say for me, the highlights, 2016 was a moment where I go, okay, something's really wrong. Like I'm a Jesus follower. I thought we're all Jesus followers. We're voting for this guy named Trump after this Hollywood Access tape comes out. We're calling, you know, like we're justifying it. Like something is way wrong, right? So already alarm bells are in my head are like, they're screaming and I'm outspoken. I have a podcast about this. I'm getting a lot of pushback. I'm shocked because I'm thinking like, wait, well, how is me saying, no, I don't pledge allegiance to the flag radical for a Jesus follower when my allegiance is to Jesus and not a flag? Or why is it radical to say we shouldn't have the American flag in our church services? This is not radical stuff. But for a lot of people, like you said, the Christianity of America is Christianity and anything else is a threat, right? And then all of a sudden for me, what really rocked me and really just for me broke, the dam just shattered, was the Ahmaud Arbery situation. That murder, I mean, was when I went on my Facebook and said, this is horrible, this is wrong. I mean, I don't know, I'm just feel my passion at this point, you know, just saying, we have to do something here, you know? And it was the beginning for me to realize like, okay, racism is, it's not gone like I thought or I was taught. There is a problem here. Mm-hmm. Then we had George Floyd, mm-hmm. Breonna Taylor, mm-hmm. you know, and as I got more outspoken, I found people more and more who were deconstructing their faith. And by faith, it's really theology. You know, I tell people you're having a crisis of theology, not of faith. Most of us still believe in Jesus. We believe in God, but our theology is the crisis, you know? And that's why, and this is not a bragging point at all, but my account went from in December, 2,000 people to now almost 20,000 today, you know? And it's not because of me. I'm just saying what we all think, you know? Right. Hey, this nationalism thing is an issue. Hey, we should be more open, more room at the table. We should listen to Black voices and BIPOC voices, right? Things that that now to me are so common sense to me were not a while ago, of course. I had to progress there. But I say that, Jamar, because if it's any consolation to you, there are, I can safely say, millions of white evangelicals who are saying, we have a major problem. Christian nationalism is the threat, not CRT, and we have got to push the church to reform as quickly as possible because we have major problems. Major problems.
The problem I'm encountering is the folks who you're describing and that you're a part of, we have to mobilize.
I agree.
We have to get together and coordinate a lot better than we have been. And if you look, I think we were talking before the show, if you look at Amazon Books and say the Christian social issues category, which is where my books are listed, the top 5-10 spots are these folks who are promoting Christian nationalism, or putting out crappy books, refuting straw man arguments to promote this fear mongering about critical race theory. And so the question, what do we do about that? Right. Okay. So theologically speaking, I am more and more convinced that the people who are following Jesus, whatever that means, you know, for how they view race, how they do church, like they're changing their lives in order to conform to Christ. We're always going to be a remnant.
Yeah.
We're always going to be leaven. We're always going to be mustard seed. We're going to be Gideon's army in comparison to the folks who go another way. Even folks who call themselves Christian, right? So there's that level of understanding that we'll never be, if you're waiting for the majority to get on the same page about racial justice, you're going to be dust before that happens, right?
Right.
All that being said, we can still do a lot better coordinating and mobilizing the resources we have. I don't care at this point whether it's self-serving, but The Witness, when we struggle financially, and there's zero reason for it, given the amount of awareness and attention that you know has been given to racial justice in the past year and a half, right? Like, if you really want to do something, and this is one of the things where even white people who are awakening to these issues is still a steep learning curve, you've actually got to support Black people. It cannot be more white people, even if they're saying good things.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
So
Beth Moore has done me a great service several times simply by retweeting, simply by recommending my books. Now, she has an incredible platform and voice and everything like that. But if that happens on a micro scale again and again and again and again, it makes a difference. And so one of the turns I'm hoping that white folks who are, you know, racially conscious now or really want racial, it's like, it's not going to be the same cast of characters leading the way anymore.
Right.
It can't be, and it shouldn't be.
100%.
It's often been said that the Black church is the truest expression of Christianity in the United States. Hmm. If we look at Christian nationalism as sort of the most widespread and corrupt form, then the form of Christianity that arose in direct opposition to Christian nationalism and white supremacy is going to be much more true.
Yeah.
And that's what the Black church tradition is. I'm not saying, you know, it's perfect because it's filled with human beings who are fallen and sinners and all of that stuff. But when you look at sort of the thrust of understanding the faith, is going to come from folks like Black Christians. More generally, it's going to come from the marginalized and oppressed. It's going to come from women. It's going to come from our Latin descended folks. It's going to come from, Native American and indigenous people, right? It's going to come from these groups, but especially in the context of the United States, where white supremacy was enshrined in race-based chattel slavery, and we're still dealing with the legacy of all that.
Yeah.
The Black church.
Yeah.
And if we are not amplifying the voices of Black Christians, Micah Edmondson is brilliant. The way he theologizes, he's a Black Presbyterian. They have those. He's a Black Presbyterian pastor and church planner. He and his brilliant wife, Dr. Christina Edmondson, they both have their PhDs, recently relocated to Nashville, and they're planting a church, Koinonia Church there. But he wrote a book on MLK's theology of redemptive suffering. He was the first Black PhD out of Calvin Seminary in Grand Rapids. How many people know about Micah Edmondson? Malcolm Foley is my good friend, doing incredible work. He's religious studies. He's getting his PhD studying Black Protestant reactions to lynching from 1890 to 1920.
Wow.
You want to talk about some good theologizing? That's what he's studying, right? How many folks know about Malcolm Foley and his work? The Ladies of Truth's Table, Christina Edmondson, Michelle Higgins, Ekemini Uwan.
I found them on Instagram, I think, a couple of days ago, but I never heard of them until recently.
Listen, I'm just saying, if we want to really take action, if we want to end this podcast and say, what can I do? Immediately follow these folks, amplify these folks, quote these folks, make memes and put the picture and the words on there so it's shareable. Like, do everything in your power to make sure these good, healthy, biblically sound, prophetic, justice-oriented voices get heard. That's all I'm saying. And fund it.
Yeah.
First of all, we have this reticence to talk about money. I have been with a broke nonprofit long enough not to care anymore. And I'm asking for money constantly. I'm sorry. I don't know how long this goes.
As long as you want. I got nowhere to be.
I'm saying, this is what is a gut punch to me. The Witness Foundation just launched its first cohort of Witness Fellows. This is six people. Four of them, they're getting a total of $100,000 each over the course of 2 years to fund their racial justice oriented organizations. One is working with people who have been released from incarceration. Another is working with Black disabled folks in Black churches. Another one, they're splitting the money, but there was a group in Northwest Arkansas that said, we got a lot of work to do here and we've got some people doing good work. We want to help fundraise for it and give it to some of these local organizers. If that happened, look, in any other field, if you had a $50,000, book award, if you had a $50,000 fellowship, I'm in academia, most fellowships, $20,000 or $30,000 fellowship is at the premium level.
Okay.
Most might give you $3,000, $5,000, $10,000. If you got a $50,000 academic fellowship, you would be in an elite category. When we fund six different people at that level for 2 years, not a blip on the radar. We did press releases. We sent it to our contacts. Nobody took it up. We raised $500,000 by the sweat of our brow through small donations. We didn't have, we had a couple five-digit donations, but most of them were just small donations. What we need, if I'm dreaming big, is an endowment. If we had a $6 million endowment, we could fully fund 5 fellows every year just off the interest and wouldn't have to fundraise for that ever again. If we had a $10 million endowment, we could fund the operating budget for the Black Christian Collective and the Witness Foundation. And to put that in perspective, when you look at ministries like Samaritan's Purse, which is led by Franklin Graham, they have almost a $1 billion budget. It's like 900 million.
Wow.
Who was it? Jeff Bezos just gave Van Jones $10 million to give away. Just here you go. Right. 10 million.
Right.
And you're saying, and I'm saying, our churches, our Christian people who were so catalyzed, like you were, with Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, we can't put together enough money to fund Black Christian ministries, not just The Witness. Jude 3 Project with Lisa Fields, Be the Bridge with Latasha Morrison, so many others, you know?
Yeah.
Truth's Table. They got Patreon. Go become a Patreon supporter. When did it get to where writing a check was like, oh, well, that's beneath me? When you look at the racial wealth gap, you understand that writing a check to Black organizations is a disruptive, confrontational thing to do in a white supremacist society. That's my soapbox. I'm sorry. Done.
Please. I mean, Jamar, don't be sorry. I have you on because I, you know, we have to have this conversation. I mean, asking for money is awkward, you know, like I've done it. It's a bizarre feeling, but it's the reality and we can't feel bad about it. Right. You cannot feel bad about that. And I like what you're saying, because honestly, I'm being very transparent. It's very challenging for me to hear you say that, you know, think, all right, like, how do I help be part of this change? You know, like I have my family to feed, but also like, how can we, you know, make this work? Because we know that there's plenty to go around, right? If Jeff Bezos can fly to space and not even take a 0.01% pay cut, right? Certainly the money is there. All right. And we can talk about capitalism a different day and how that's linked to white supremacy. Yeah. All right. But I think my audience, we're hitting them enough over the head, you know,
you're getting in enough trouble with one episode. Yeah,
exactly. You know, but I am with you when you made a comment, and I'm grateful for your time, and I'm fine as long as you are, but I know we're at the hour mark, and I want to be respectful. But you made a comment that I've actually been thinking about a lot too, which is how do we mobilize? You know, how do we get connected? How, because there are enough people that are at least at like the first stone of like, okay, I know it's not nationalism and there's something better on the other side, right? And we're kind of, there's all these accounts now kind of pushing people in like this deconstruction and rethinking, renegotiating their faith kind of moment on every level, whether it's racial lines, theological lines, you know, all kinds of things. And I'm like, okay, I'm seeing this. Accounts are growing. My accounts are growing. I know that your platform is continuing to grow. I'm like, okay, there is at least an aroma in the air of like, there's something going on, right? I'm sure we can look through history and find these moments. I look back again at the Wesleyan tradition of how, you know, Oberlin College had the Underground Railroad. They were breaking the law, you know, as evangelicals, breaking the law. They were the first ones to ordain women in the 1800s. You know, I'm like, these are my people, right? How do we bring that tradition back? Right. So I am with you, and I'm hoping that as some of these people kind of start getting some momentum, we start finding each other, that there's a way for us to say, okay, we're adding more seats to this table. You know, there is something powerful happening here. How do we push this and really get what's happening out to the mainstream?
Yep.
Because it needs to happen, Jamar.
The roadmap is out there. I mean, guys like Dr. Pinnell have been talking about this, right? Here's what I think. I think, we need to have a fully funded Black Christian confab, invite only, smallish group, 10, 20 people, no tweeting, no video record. We get the best Black Christian thinkers in a room and we for a couple of days and we say, what do we need to do?
Yeah.
That's one thing. And that needs to be fully funded, needs to be somewhere gorgeous because this work is exhausting.
Yeah.
And it needs to function also as a retreat and a recovery. Yeah. So I don't know. That's probably $75,000 or something. And then we also need, beyond that, the stuff that everyday folks can do. Get on Goodreads, get on Amazon, get on Target, Barnes & Noble, wherever you get your books, and buy it and then leave a review.
Yeah.
Leave a review. I mean, that's, anybody can do that, right?
Absolutely. Read
it, leave a review. Amplify it in whatever way you can. Even if that's just, I got three friends on a group chat and I'm going to make the book recommendation. Or you've got a favorite podcast that you listen to, New Evangelicals. You need to have this author on, or you need to have this pastor on.
Yeah.
You can advocate, right? Advocate in terms of amplifying. And every single one of us has the opportunity to amplify somehow, some way. The other thing we need to do is, it's going to take the virtue of humility for white people to take a step back and make space for Black and brown folks. Right?
Yeah.
Because you have the historic and contemporary platform. Even if it's not a, you know, Beth Moore platform or Tim Whitaker platform, right? You take up the space in the room. Mm. Your voice is loud in the conversation.
Yeah.
Which is going to mean not that you are diminished or any less, but that in a sort of Philippians 3 kind of way,
right?
You take a step back so that others who have been forced back
totally
can now have the opportunity to take up the right amount of space that they deserve as image bearers of God.
Absolutely.
And not have to shrink because of white supremacy.
I'm reminded
saying those are some ways that we can, you know, do something.
I'm reminded of, I was listening to a Bible Project, and Tim Mackey was talking about the early church and like just some of the dynamics. And he was saying how, you know, for Paul, when you're at one of his points is he has in mind that at the table, there's an equity that's given, right? And that naturally, the people at that table were not didn't have equality in the culture. You might have had the orphan there, the widow there, the rich person there, the slave there. And at the table, the rich is de-elevated and the poor is elevated. It's an equality, right?
Look at that.
And there's a very, like, dare I use the word biblical, you know, concept to, like, people realizing who are – even if I didn't, obviously I couldn't control where or how I was born. We all know that. But given what I've inherited in this white privilege sense, to know, okay, at the table of Christ, I come down and people come up and we meet and then we're equals, right? And then we try and help grow together from there. I think there's something super beautiful about that. And it's Christ-like, isn't it? Isn't the point to sacrifice for the other, to love the other? You know, isn't that the point?
Well, now you're getting into the really radical nature of the gospel.
Yeah.
Because what you're talking about goes so against the grain of what is normal that you will be a weirdo. You will absolutely stick out for doing that, because that is not the norm. And I just want to touch on two quick points, because I felt like, you know, I rambled a lot, but there was a point in some of the other stuff.
Sure.
I want to bring up the issue of white lash.
Hmm.
Backlash.
Okay.
You know,
got it.
You know, every major movement for progress for Black people has been met with equal, if not greater, backlash from white people. Mm. And I specify Black and white because it's when Black people make progress that you see the most vitriolic, the most sustained, the most widespread backlash, which is not to play the oppression Olympics. It's not to say that other groups don't experience backlash. It's to say that the construct of whiteness is most diametrically opposed to Blackness and Black people, right? So if white supremacy is the issue, then whenever the sort of most demonized group, which is Black people, make progress, you're going to see the sharpest backlash. This happened after the Civil War. I write about this in The Color of Compromise. Mm-hmm. Reconstruction, some of us have heard about, that's ended in 1877 with a compromise that gives Rutherford B. Hayes the presidency in exchange for withdrawing federal troops from the South, which means there's nobody there to enforce Black civil rights. And then that period is called hauntingly redemption. Because now they've taken this Christian word that's supposed to be a good news word. And what redemption means in U.S. history, the 19th century, is white people creating a new form of racial oppression called Jim Crow after the abolition of slavery. So there's the backlash there. The civil rights movement. The backlash to the civil rights movement has been the rise of the religious right, has been the war on crime, has been the demonizing of the inner city, that kind of a thing. And now in the wake of the 2020 election, when in so many ways, Black voters played a critical part in getting Joe Biden elected over Trump, the backlash is an insurrection on January 6th. Yep. The backlash is, quote unquote, the big lie that the election was stolen.
That's still being propagated right now as we speak.
Still being propagated and promulgated. And I'm going to say that as a Christian, we ought to be dedicated to the truth. And I don't care if it's your favorite broadcaster, podcaster, pundit saying the election was stolen.
Right.
Stolen. It is a lie.
It's a lie. Totally.
And we cannot get down with that. That's part of the Ten Commandments.
It's 101, right? Man. 101.
It's basic. So that's one point. We're always faced with backlash, and in particular when Black people get our rights and make progress. Second thing I'll say, we're talking about questions, right? When you're trying to talk to somebody and they say, just preach the gospel, I want to ask them, what's the how?
Yeah.
How does it work?
That's
okay.
Good.
So
that's good.
Just preach the gospel, just stick to the Bible, and that's going to change. And I'm saying, how does that actually change our racial situation? Well, as you know, somebody converts, they're going to be more like Jesus. They're not going to hate people. They're going to treat people better. Okay, cool. How does it work? How does that approach work at my seminary, where when I started, there were less than 5 Black Americans in a city who are students, in a city that was 80% Black. Second highest proportion of Black people in any city, over 100,000 people, Jackson, Mississippi. When I started there, I could count on one hand the number of Black American students. Now you tell me how your just preach the gospel methodology does something about that.
Right.
Or does something about the disproportionate, the fact that Black women die in maternity-related deaths at 3 times the rate of white women. Tell me, just tell me the process.
Right.
Tell me the formula. Tell me the method. Tell me the plan for how just preach the gospel saves Black mamas.
Right.
So that the Black babies who were so pro-life about have their mothers to grow up with. Tell me how that works.
Right.
Not even in a confrontation. I'm just saying, how does it work?
Right. Right.
I have yet to find somebody who has the just preach the gospel approach to have anything close to a workable solution for the real racial disparities that we still face.
Well, I think the unfortunate reality is because we've really given a soundbite Christianity to people, right? And we have these little lines, right? Oh, just preach the gospel. But no one's thought beyond that. No one's thought, like you said, no one's taken that and thought, okay, how does that change a society? By doing that, it turns out if we are a Christian nation, we're doing a terrible job at it, right? Like, let's assume we are a Christian nation. It's embarrassing, right? So it's like once you go, like you said, you said earlier, a centimeter deep. Once you just tap on that, and underneath it's hollow. There's no answer, which is a bummer because these are some of the people claiming to be the most theologically sound.
That's right.
What? It honestly, sometimes, if it feels this way for me, I can only imagine for you, but I feel like I'm in the upside down. I'm in the twilight zone. Like, am I being gaslighted here by everyone I know? Because are we not seeing this?
Right. How can I be the only one around here who notices this? I get it. Again, Black Christianity, Black church tradition, you're in good company. And if you go over to The Witness, one of the most valuable things, I think, is knowing you're not alone. Yeah. And you know, organizations like The Witness, that's a powerful function that it serves, is just to say, no, you're not the only one who sees this. You're not the only one who thinks this is not the way of Christ. You're not the only one who is deconstructing their theology. I love that, you know, the differentiation you made between theology and faith, right? There are more people, but you got to find them.
Yeah.
And guess what? It's going to be in places that you haven't traditionally looked because you're trying to do something that's non-traditional in a Christian nationalist society. You're trying to be Christian.
Well, listen, I mean, on that note, I you and I can go forever. We haven't talked about voting and so many other things, you know, but for now, this is the book, everyone. I have it right here. So there's Jamar, The Coming Race War, Expanded Edition, A Cry for Justice from Civil Rights to Black Lives Matter. Truly a great read. I'm going to make sure I put in the show notes links to this, The Witness, all that good stuff that you mentioned. Also, Jamar, by the way, if you have a connection to Esau McCauley, hook me up. I've been trying to get the guy on the show for a long time. All right. I've been trying to reach out to this boy. So tell him, you know, I'm available. But I love his stuff. I read Reading While Black. Again, just so just thought-provoking, you know, just shatters all my categories. So
he's a sharp guy. Yeah,
him and Charlie Dates are on my list. So, but hey, I appreciate you making time. Honestly, Jamar, it means a ton. And, you know, I don't know. I'm behind you all the way, man. Hey, like
all the heat you get, man, it's your fault because you ask these questions. You got me fired up. So I really enjoyed it. And we need it. We need these conversations. So I appreciate the time.
We did your book, How to Fight Racism, for our book study last year. And it was great. There was like 10 of us and people loved the book. We used the ARC, you know, model. It was awesome. So I, you know, again, you're doing great work. I can only imagine how exhausting it must be. Frankly, I can tell, you know, from how you talk, it just got to weigh a lot. But whatever we can do to push you guys forward, we're fully behind it. So
I love it. I appreciate it, man.
Absolutely, man.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.